This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's Friday, March 22nd. The second biggest company in the world is being sued by the U.S. government, and the reason may be right in the palm of your hand. We start here. The DOJ brings a major antitrust case against Apple.
Apple has gone from revolutionizing the smartphone market to stalling its advancement.
Could the iPhone be so dominant that it makes for a monopoly? Your whole life you've heard about the value of home ownership. Might renting actually be a better deal?
It's about 40% more expensive to buy right now than to rent.
New data suggests those classic tree-lined streets could lead to financial dead ends. And a man needed a kidney. Well, he got one from a pig.
There is a severe organ shortage in this country.
The breakthrough that could revolutionize organ transplants. From ABC News, this is Start Here. I'm Stephen Portnoy in Washington. Hey, you may have noticed no Brad today. His voice is acting up, so I'll be doing my best Brad Milkey impersonation to guide you through today's news. There's a decent chance you're hearing me do this impersonation over an iPhone. That's how I listen to this show. It's how I've been walking around with the whole world in my pocket since 2007. Children have been born and have learned to drive since I got my first iPhone. And it just occurs to me now that between the MacBook that's in front of me, the other one behind me, the iPad off to the side of my desk, the Apple TV that's on the wall, and the watch that's on my wrist, I have six Apple devices all around me. And that sheer dominance, the monstrous market share of not just Apple, but also of companies like Google and Meta, has become a major concern in Europe, where the EU has given big tech a real regulatory headache. Well, yesterday, here in the U.S., the federal government filed suit against the world's second largest company, alleging that Apple's domination of the smartphone industry today is akin to the Standard Oil, Ma, Bell, and Microsoft monopolies of the 20th century. All of them were ultimately broken up. The 88-page lawsuit has the Justice Department accusing Apple of violating antitrust laws to keep users reliant on what might just be the most ubiquitous device on planet Earth. So let's bring in ABC's Alex Mallon, who covers the Justice Department and has been digging through the government's filing. Alex, how significant was yesterday's announcement?
It's incredibly significant, Stephen. This has been in the works at DOJ for the past several years. This investigation actually started in 2019 under the Trump administration. And what they really wanted to drill down on it was, how did Apple become this dominant force in the smartphone market? And it, basically, the DOJ says that they ended up controlling 65% of that market. And according to this DOJ lawsuit that was filed yesterday, they did it by illegal means of essentially turning themselves into a monopoly, and in their words, creating this moat around this castle that is Apple, and preventing their competitors from even having access to this empire that they had built. And they did this, they say, by making it harder or more difficult for platforms like Android to be able to compete or communicate with iPhone users.
Apple has maintained monopoly power in the smartphone market not simply by staying ahead of the competition on the merits, but by violating federal antitrust law.
And we heard yesterday in this press conference at the Justice Department, Attorney General Merrick Garland and Deputy Attorney General Lisa Monaco, as well as other DOJ officials, speaking about how Apple had essentially used all of these illegal means to go about for years, creating this dominant position that made it the leader of the world's smartphone market.
Apple has gone from revolutionizing the smartphone market to stalling its advancement.
Well, Alex, why is it such a big deal if the iPhone is popular? I mean, I have one. A lot of people have them. What's the problem?
And I think that's the point that Attorney General Garland made in his remarks yesterday, Stephen. He said that, it's not illegal to be a monopoly, but what makes it illegal is when you stop focusing on making your products better and turn your focus to making other products worse and locking out people from the market that is supposed to, spur innovation and basically using their iOS system to block people from creating, innovative new apps. Basically, they're saying that the consumers are being prevented from having access access to real innovative new apps and ways to communicate that Apple has sought to hinder in order to create and maintain its dominant position in the market.
Apple selectively restricts access to the points of connection between third-party apps and the iPhone's operating system, degrading the functionality of non-Apple apps and accessories.
They talked about specifically how Apple created barriers to make it so Android users would have to come over to Apple. I mean, when you open up your texts and you are messaging with an Android user, there's that green bubble. And another way, Stephen, that this lawsuit mentions is how Apple used its control over their iOS operating system to block, you know, competitors from creating new apps that would be compatible with iPhones, to essentially block people out of going into Apple wallets, making Apple the sole beneficiary of its Apple wallet system. Attorney General Garland pointed out that when you're messaging with an Android user and they want to send you a high quality video, that comes across often as super grainy and just unwatchable.
As a result, iPhone users perceive rival smartphones as being lower quality because the experience of messaging friends and family who do not own iPhones is worse.
In the lawsuit, they cite a comment from Apple CEO Tim Cook when he was actually confronted by a questioner who said, you know, I've been messaging with my mother and, you know, it'd be really great if I could get, you know, videos from her, but she's an Android user. And Tim Cook's response to that was, well, it's time to get her an iPhone. And essentially that's the culture that DOJ is talking about in this lawsuit, that they say that Apple tried to prop up making itself the only option for people who want to use a smartphone.
So other than that response from Tim Cook, what else is Apple saying about this?
They argue that none of their activities, Stephen, were unlawful, and it was all about creating what they call, quote, a magical experience for our users. Another defense to this, Stephen, from Apple is that they believe that this kind of way of blocking out third-party apps actually makes their product the most secure in the world. In their defense, they say that this action by the Justice Department could, quote, create a dangerous precedent empowering government to take a heavy hand in designing people's technology. They say, you know, this is generally competitive behavior, and that's what they're going to try and fight out what is going to be, no doubt, a prolonged, lengthy legal battle over this case.
You know, I'm not afraid to admit I'm old enough to remember when the Justice Department sued Microsoft, saying that it was crowding out an app called Netscape that was a web browser, that Microsoft was shoving Internet Explorer down everyone's throats. Microsoft lost that case. So what is the outcome the Justice Department had there, possibly foretell about what could happen to Apple?
Well, what we heard at this briefing yesterday, Stephen, was actually a Justice Department official told a group of reporters that they believe this is going to largely mirror what we saw with the Microsoft case. But as you also know, that case got wrapped up in litigation for a better part of a decade, I think well over a decade. It went to the district court. It went to an appeals court before it kind of was chopped up into what the ruling ended up being. And by the time that ruling came down, Internet Explorer, the web browser you're talking about, was a thing of the past. So, I mean, what we could be looking at if this mirrors that case is maybe the iPhone is by that time a thing of the past. But really what the Justice Department says they're trying to counter is this culture at Apple. As it continues developing products in the future, they believe that it's essential to confront this behavior to make sure that they know that, you know, the best innovation in their minds is when you allow for competition in the markets, and not just the cell phones and not just, you know, iWatches, but in other technology that Apple's involved with as well.
This Biden Justice Department has taken an aggressive posture in antitrust cases, also pursuing them against Google and Meta. Alex Mallon covers the Justice Department for us. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Stephen.
Next up on Start Here, why buy? Is the housing market so lousy that it's just better to keep on renting? We're back after the break.
With daylight saving time upon us, we're looking forward to more daylight and longer days from March through November. And while setting our clocks forward gives us the illusion of more time, it doesn't necessarily help businesses find qualified candidates any sooner. Fear not, there is a solution. ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter is your 24/7 hiring partner working tirelessly to connect you with the right candidate. Once you post your job on ZipRecruiter, it gets distributed to over 100 job sites, ensuring you reach a diverse pool of qualified individuals. Their smart technology scans thousands of resumes, matching you with people whose skills perfectly align with your job requirements. Spring forward with a new hiring partner, ZipRecruiter, and find top talent sooner. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a qualified quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address to try ZipRecruiter for free, ZipRecruiter.com/start here. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/start here. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
We've got the exclusive view behind the table. Every day, right after the show, while the topics are still hot, the ladies go deeper into the moments that make the view, the view. The Views Behind the Table podcast. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
You might have heard the Federal Reserve announce this week that it's keeping interest rates steady. Inflation isn't gone, but it has come down from its recent highs over the past few years. And with that, economists are growing hopeful that someday soon it might become cheaper to borrow money. But that turnaround probably isn't happening tomorrow. We saw yesterday that mortgage rates have risen again up to near 7% average nationwide. It might make you wonder, is it worth buying a house right now? A new analysis is helping us dig into that question, and ABC's Elizabeth Schulze, who covers economics, is going to dig into it with us. Elizabeth, what does this new report suggest is a better deal right now, buying or renting?
Right. Hey, Stephen. Well, the report is pretty clear that right now, if you're just looking at it on a monthly cost basis, it is a lot cheaper to rent than it is to buy. So this is an analysis from CBRE. It's a firm that tracks real estate prices across the country. And what it finds is that the average monthly payment right now on a new apartment lease is about $2,100. When you look at the average monthly payment on a new home mortgage, it's almost $3,000. So in other words, it's about 40% more expensive to buy right now than to rent when you're just comparing those monthly costs on average.
The challenges are with the first-time buyers who want to be on the ownership side. It's been a difficult time, high mortgage rates, high home prices.
Obviously, this data is going to change based on where you live. There are some markets that rent is more. There are markets where it's a lot more to buy. But when you're looking at it just as an apples-to-apples comparison, what this is telling you is that rent is a lot cheaper at this moment in time. And notably, this data also shows that rent is going to stay cheaper for at least 5 years. These analysts are kind of forecasting what mortgage payments are going to look like, and they take into account mortgage rates, they take into account estimates for home prices, and then rent growth. And what they find is over the next 5 years, mortgage payments are going to be more expensive than rent. And their conclusion is that that is an additional hurdle for people who are trying to make that leap from renting into buying.
But I'm still trying to understand, how could it be that rent, which is basically paying somebody else's mortgage with their expenses and a profit on top of it, how could that turn out to be cheaper than just paying your own mortgage?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And to be honest, it has not always been this way. When you look back historically at the data, for years before the pandemic, rent was significantly more expensive on a monthly basis than a mortgage payment was. And that was because you are paying for a service, you are paying someone who's gonna do your maintenance if something goes wrong.
I felt like for all the money I was spending on rent, it just made more sense to buy. Just knowing that my money is going somewhere, it might as well go towards my own investment.
Even if you are paying less on your lease, you aren't building up the equity that you would when you're buying a house. So you're building up that money, you're putting it back into your own pocket, versus when you're renting, you're kind of flushing that money down the drain.
Everything that we fall in love with and I get excited about, we get outbid immediately. Interest right now is killing my bottom line.
But the authors of this report say that there's a really big factor at play here that accounts for why home payments are now so much more than rent. And that's because there is this housing shortage. They say there's a shortage of 4 million homes right now for people who are trying to buy them. And a lot of those are single family units. So all of these people who want to buy cannot find homes where they're trying to buy them. And that has continued to drive up prices, while at the same time, mortgage rates have gone up. That's exacerbated those monthly home payments.
I was definitely getting a little discouraged.
The first two offers we put in, we lost out to all cash offers.
And while you have this big housing shortage of single family homes, you don't have that same thing going on in the apartment rental market. There are a lot more apartments that are available. So landlords are not in the same position where they can be squeezing people as much as people who are trying to buy and get into those very few units that exist of homes for sale are getting squeezed themselves.
All right. So it's a renter's market now. But how soon could things change? I mean, couldn't the rental market soon spiral out of control too?
Right. Well, and this report does think this gap between renting and buying will get smaller as time goes on, that this market will get a little bit more in balance as more homes are built and as people just ultimately have to rent because they can't find the homes and then their rent does go up. So the expectation is that in 5 years, it'll be about 11% more expensive to buy on a monthly basis than it is to rent. But the underlying issue here is still comes down to not enough supply. And that's something, in order to kind of get this more in balance, those prices to be more even, there would need to be a significantly higher number of homes that are being built for all the demand that's out there.
All right. Elizabeth Schulze, thanks.
Thanks so much, Stephen.
Yesterday, scientists at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston made big news. Or should I say they made pig news. Earlier this month, they implanted a genetically modified pig kidney inside a 62-year-old man. It's actually the latest in a series of procedures involving the organs of swine being transplanted into human bodies. In a world where there are rarely enough donors, we could wind up seeing a lot more recipients with pig parts. Sony Salzman from our medical unit. Sony, tell us about what they announced yesterday.
Yeah, absolutely. I will say this is a world first. Yesterday at a press conference, researchers in Massachusetts announced that for the first time, a pig kidney has been surgically implanted into a living person.
Last Saturday, following years and years of study, decades of study, months of planning, and hours of surgery, hope became a reality for our patient, Rick Slayman.
So this is, as you said, a 62-year-old man who was at end-stage renal disease. He was on dialysis, which some of your listeners may be familiar with. And he was really, really struggling. And so this is novel science. But what the researchers did is they took a genetically modified pig kidney and they basically surgically implanted it into this man in the same way that you would if an organ had become eligible through the organ donation system.
We thoroughly discussed with the patient on multiple occasions all the known and unknown risks of the procedure.
And it was really significant. And in fact, during that press conference, when the researchers were talking about this accomplishment, talking about some of the details, you know, one of those researchers got choked up.
My deepest gratitude.
He became emotionally overwhelmed. He was talking about the bravery of the patient who had come forward. And, you know, he had to rest and kind of regroup before continuing on with his presentation.
I cannot think of a more dedicated team in the world, and I'm honored to be part of it.
We should note, by the way, this 62-year-old man in Boston who had this procedure, he already had received a human kidney. It didn't work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, he had already kind of run through a lot of his options. So this man was running out of options. And I think that you could really tell during that press conference that the researchers had been working with him for some time, were really kind of awed by his bravery moving forward, but also just so desperate because this patient, like so many of their other patients, was potentially facing death here. And that is kind of part of the urgency of this research is the fact that so many people are waiting for those organs and so many people will die waiting for those organs.
We have heard of pig parts being implanted into humans. There was a pig heart that was implanted last year. I have to ask, why pigs?
So pigs were chosen for this type of research because they are roughly the same size as us and because that's where the researcher's been. There's a company called eGenesis that has this genetically modified kidney product, effectively, that is very far along.
At eGenesis, we are committed to revolutionizing the treatment of organ failure and transplant.
So they've genetically modified it in a way that researchers hope it will be safe for use in humans, that it will, once it's put inside a human, it won't be rejected and it will be safe for the long term, although that remains to be seen. And, you know, I will say the transplant was 6 days ago. And since then, this patient, he is recovering well and he could soon go home. So we don't know how long this transplant will last. But right now it's kind of a wait and see situation and it is a major milestone.
It does seem a bit risky, though, right? I mean, if they don't know it's going to work, they're just trying it out?
Right. It does seem risky. The researchers did get FDA approval to move forward with this surgery and this transplant. You know, there are potentially ethical concerns, but there's medical concerns as well. And, you know, I think one of the biggest medical concerns is that We don't know for sure if this is going to work long term. Now, in addition to the kidney work that scientists have done, they have also transplanted two hearts into living patients. And those patients, you know, there's some thought that it did extend their life, but they did live for weeks after those transplants. Those patients were, you know, really in serious medical distress previous to that. So there is a thought that it extended their lives, but we're not talking about, you know, very long here. And then in addition to that, there is just concerns potentially about, you know, porcine viruses, and we have to really make sure we're accounting for all of that. This gene editing is very important to make sure that the body accepts the new organ and there aren't any unintended consequences. So again, all of this speaks to the fact that this is very exciting. This is a milestone, but scientifically, it is still early days.
This first ever transplantation of a genetically modified porcine kidney to a patient is an extraordinary leap for the field and our vision for a world in which no patient dies waiting for an organ.
And what they point out is that, you know, there could potentially be an endless supply of pigs. So, you know, that is certainly possible. There are really significant issues and challenges with getting organs to the right people, to the people who really need them. So, I mean, I guess what we could say is, why are we even talking about this? Like, why are we even talking about a universe in which we are using organs that came from a pig and putting them in people, right? And the reason is there is a severe organ shortage in this country. Every day, people die waiting on the organ transplant list. You know, of the nearly 89,000 people waiting for a kidney, only about 16,000 a year will get one. Right? And so people are dying every day. So this is a really urgent crisis. And that's why this science, it sounds very science fiction, but it is kind of crucially important. And it is seen as one of the most promising ways to save those people's lives.
Fascinating, Sony. You know, you got to think about it. I know lots of people who, depending on their ethics or even their religion, they wouldn't even consider eating pigs, never mind putting a part of a pig into their own body. But anyway, Sony Saltzman is with our ABC News medical unit. Sony, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate you having me.
Okay, one more quick break. When we come back, how actors and sound effects men helped save the world. One Last Thing is next.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
And one last thing. Something pretty awesome happened here in D.C. yesterday. A handful of surviving veterans of World War II, and there really are just a handful left, men about 100 years old, received Congress's highest honor for their part in what was known as the Ghost Army.
They've just finished a recording. This one was only the sound of actual construction.
It had nothing to do with goblins or Stay Puft Marshmallow Men, but strangely enough, it did involve inflatable tanks.
The best loudspeakers for the military requirements have been developed. Under ideal conditions, they were found capable of projecting sound for 15 miles.
You see, the Ghost Army was a strategy of battlefield deception employed after the D-Day invasion. From 1944 until the end of the war a year later, the U.S. Army recruited soldiers from art schools, advertising agencies, communications firms, actors, technicians, and creative types were sought. The mission? To create the perception of American forces where they weren't actually positioned to get the Axis enemy to move its troops. They used life-sized featherweight inflatable tanks that looked real, sound effects, and even radio transmissions to fake out the Germans. And it worked.
The Ghost Army's deception mission demanded a special kind of courage. To project strength when you have none, to purposely draw enemy fire to keep it from falling on others, a dangerous business, not for the faint of heart.
Yesterday, three of the soldiers who served in these units, now aged 99 and 100, were on hand to receive Congress's highest honor, the Congressional Gold Medal.
Yeah, I'm very proud and happy to be here to receive this honor. Thank you.
The official commendation said the men's actions saved lives and made significant contributions to the defeat of the Axis powers. You've heard of the Code Breakers, the Code Talkers, the Manhattan Project, Rosie the Riveter on the home front. And now you know, painters, technicians, soundmen, and even actors had a role in the war effort too. As a radio historian, I just love that story. You know, they had to keep it a secret for decades. That program was not declassified until 1996. We'll Start Here is produced by Kelly Therese, Jen Newman, Brenda Salinas-Baker, Vika Aronson, Cameron Chertavian, Anthony Ali, Marwa Muwaki, and the team's newest producer, Amira Williams. Ariel Chester is our social media producer. Josh Cohan is director of podcast programming. Brad Milkey is our managing editor. Laura Mayer is our executive producer. Brad sends his thanks this week to Lakia Brown, John Newman, Tara Gimbel, and Liz Alessi. Special thanks to Chris Barry and Andrew Evans. Doing my best Brad Milkey impersonation, I'm Stephen Portnoy in Washington. We'll catch you again next week.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.